anonymous podcast listener, we've got just the thing for you. I'm Dave Stevens, a B2B marketer and chair of the Business Marketing Club Network. And in this episode of the Business Marketing Club podcast, I'll be speaking about personalization in B2B marketing. I'll be talking to Global Marketing Director at Worldpay, Sameet Vamani, CEO of Turtle, Nick Mason, and Director of Rich Contacts, Simon Watson. Also, Gail Cogswell will share a key lesson that she's taken on the journey to being a business consultant in 5G propositions. So, listen on. Personalization is a key focus for B2B marketing in the new decade. We're told that just personalization by name isn't enough to be truly effective, that we should look to hyper-personalization in our marketing, and that personalization should extend through the sales funnel and into the customer lifecycle. But watch out, because we're also told that the latest research suggests that micro-targeting to existing customers is neither necessary nor wise. My first guest to talk about personalization is Global Marketing Director at Worldpay, Sameet Vamani. Sameet, thank you for coming to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
First of all, tell us about Worldpay.
So Worldpay is one of the largest payment acquirers in the world. We're part of a large company called FIS. And predominantly, our business is processing payments and transactions across 146 different countries, 75 billion transactions a year. And really, we're in the business of advancing the way the world pays banks and invests.
And we're talking today about personalization. So perhaps you can tell us a little bit about your background and expertise in that area.
Yes, I mean, having started life in the world of B2C, really, you know, personalization was at the core of everything that I did. So working at companies such as MoneySupermarket.com, ESPN and Trinity Mirror, building digital products, engaging customer and consumer experiences that really were focused on personalized approaches that were compelling, engaging and drove business growth. We were able to really leverage sort of the understanding of data and the understanding of how best to use, you know, a personalized approach to the customer to really drive business results. And as a result of sort of moving into B2B, I've really seen how, you know, some of the more traditional ends of B2B have been definitely on that lead generation personalized piece. As I've evolved sort of my career in B2B, it's definitely been much more focused on enterprise B2B sales and really looking at understanding how can you personalize at key account levels, at key buying committee levels, rather than individual consumer level. And there are some similarities, but there are some big differences within that. But some really great success partnering with sales teams, using social selling, as well as using sort of advanced ABM tactics and strategies to help deliver a personalized experience to the customer.
So in your experience, a B2B organization can get as much out of personalization as a B2C one?
It can. It's just the terms of reference are just slightly different. Our idea of personalization may be less one-to-one and maybe more one to an account or one to a buying committee of 8, 9, or 10 people.
So a B2B organization listening to this, thinking, oh, this is quite interesting and wanting to get started, how should they get started in this space?
So really, for a B2B organization to get started, they really need to understand sort of where are their customers at? What is their customer need when it comes to personalization? Really, ultimately, what we want to be creating is reduction of complexity, solving customer pain points, and really making it easier to do business with us. But also then from when we think about personalization, it's very much at that emotional level as much as the kind of technical and product level. Really, do we align with their values? Do we align with what their expectations are of an experience? And so that's a real good starting point, really, to focus on the customer and what the customer might be needing, and then building that, mapping that back into your organization.
Would you say that customer focus is kind of the killer strategy here?
It is. I think ultimately you have to take those signals from the customer and from the market as well. Technology has a major part to play. So as much as our customers may be giving us signals to say they expect certain things from us in terms of an experience, we have to be looking at indicators from technology and advancements, say with mobile technology or with, you know, the big players in terms of Google's and Facebook's and LinkedIn's of this world, who are driving, you know, renewed sense of what an experience looks like and what a personalized experience looks like that is different from when we look at our competitor set.
And how about some practical examples now? Because we've kind of been speaking about this in a little bit of an abstract kind of way. Yeah. So perhaps you can give us an example or two of a B2B organization that has successfully applied that kind of customer focus that you're talking about in order to do personalization well.
Yes, I mean, we never like to toot our own trumpets, but having worked for a number of organizations in the B2B space, by working at a company called Symantec, I found that was something that we did particularly well. Really, and that kind of the practical approaches that we took there were threefold. One was to really partner very heavily with our sales teams and to ensure that as we go to market, you know, to the customer, sales and marketing are joined at the hip. We're creating, you know, compelling marketing experiences that ensure that they marry with what the sales teams are looking to engage with our customers with. We're really the voice of the customer to our sales team, and we're able to ensure that they're, you know, in the best place possible to ensure that, you know, they're taking personalization in the right approach. Data. So data is pretty key to this. So as much as we look at digital as being a great opportunity for personalization, having a robust set of data across your organization, you know, without that, the whole thing falls apart. And it's the unending challenge for a B2B organization across any vertical and any industry. And then the third piece would be just your internal structure. So your internal structure of your organization, you know, if your marketing function is siloed and your marketing and sales teams are siloed, you cannot create a joined up personalized customer experience. And, you know, that's where it can fall down. So I would say data is key, you know, aligning and partnering with your sales teams and ensuring that you have an integrated approach across your company internally to mirror that experience externally.
And when Symantec did this, what was the outcome?
So, you know, we were able to, and I take a lot of pride in trying to sort of bridge some of that gap that often exists between marketing and sales in an organization. But we were able to launch one of the first ever social selling programs ever globally, working very closely with LinkedIn at the time. This was, God, 7-8 years ago, so it's now everything that everyone is doing. But really, we were able to look at understanding how could we create compelling content that was, you know, useful to the individual, that we're enabling our sales teams with the right skills and understanding of how to do marketing in a digital way, and to be the enabler for our brand. So rather than being sort of something we send over the fence that often happens, or we send leads over the fence and hope that they are driving the business goals, that we actually worked in partnership to develop the content, the marketing approach, the sales approach, the customer experience, the full end-to-end customer experience, so that we could ensure that, you know, we, you know, delivered something completely unique to our business.
And it sounds from that example as if all of that work was done in-house, I'm guessing. So is it possible to outsource any aspects of personalization? And if so, which?
I would say that it definitely is. I'd say my own experiences working in large B2B organizations are that it really requires time and the right partner who will be able to get under the skin of your business to do that. But definitely I would look to agencies to bring some of that strategic nous rather than the kind of nitty gritty nuts and bolts of things. I think a lot of, you know, B2B organizations have marketeers who can do that. But really the value that agencies bring for me is really at that strategic end, being able to provide new perspectives, new ideas, and new approaches to how we can do personalization in the marketplace.
And if I am starting up and kind of wanting to sell in the idea of personalization internally, how do I go about it? What's my elevator pitch?
I wish I had the killer answer to that question, but I do believe relationships are key. So I think that as a marketeer, it's our responsibility to really be as commercial as possible, to really understand the nuts and bolts of the commerciality of our organizations, to be able to speak the language of business, and to then frame individualization or personalization within that context, and to demonstrate and show examples within industry of companies that are doing it, companies that aren't doing it, and really be able to show that in a very stark way. But aligning that with a revenue number. And that's always key, I think, to be able to align, you know, that data point and money with an idea. And if you're able to marry those two things together, you in most cases win the argument when trying to bring forward these new ideas.
Global Marketing Director at Worldpay, Sameet Vamani, thank you very much.
Thank you.
My second guest talking about personalization is the CEO of Turtle, Nick Mason. Nick, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Dave. Good to be here. Excited.
And first of all, you should perhaps tell us what Turtle is or does.
Right. Yeah. So Turtle is not an aquatic creature. We are a content marketing platform, and we fundamentally exist to help businesses understand their audience better and forge deeper relationships through their digital content. That's why we exist.
And we're talking about personalization today. What are your qualifications to be able to talk authoritatively about personalization then?
Well, I don't have a PhD in personalization. I'm not sure that universities run such courses, but I do have a lot of sort of experience in helping customers, companies that we work with their digital content. And personalization is inevitably a topic that comes up quite a lot. So I think I'm quite well versed in the challenges and opportunities that are out there. And also, like everyone else, you know, I've kind of got my ear to the ground in terms of, you know, what's going on in other industries and other parts of the world with personalization. And something that I guess that again is perhaps slightly unique to me is that I do have a keen interest in psychology, and there's some quite interesting psychology around personalization, how it works, why it works, and how we can get it to do more for us. So no PhD, but some other things.
Some pretty impressive qualifications, I think there. So we've talked to some of the other speakers about how a business might go about starting up personalization from scratch. And I'd like to tackle a slightly different area with you, if I may, which is the business that has, you know, dabbled in personalization a little bit and had some success, and is now thinking about actually doing it on a more industrial scale. So my question is, how should a business like that go about scaling up personalization?
Well, it's funny you should ask, because, you know, that's something that we do help our customers with. I mean, you say, you know, businesses who've dabbled in personalization, I think every business under the sun pretty much is now able to send an email that says hi, first name. And that is a form of personalization, as is any form of kind of segmentation or targeting. And really, it's that whole bucket of things that is intended ultimately to lead down to treating every person as an individual. You know, so every business is already doing that. In terms of how to move further towards it, there are easy things or easier things and things that are trickier. So the things to start with really is thinking about the area which you want to expand into. So if you're already doing email personalization, what's a logical next step? Do you want to start personalizing perhaps your thought leadership in some way? you know, only showing relevant bits to relevant sectors and so on? Do you want to start personalizing your product guides because of, you know, who's reading it or what have you? And to be clear, I guess, about this, I said it before, but I'm talking about far more than just putting someone's name on something. It's really, you know, that hyper segmentation almost of stuff down to the individual. So working out that target area is kind of important. And then hand in hand with that, working out what you're hoping to get out of it. Because you need to be able to obviously demonstrate, you know, we increased our readership in our thought leadership by X, or we made our sales materials Y percent more effective, whatever. So those two kind of, you know, what are we doing and what result do we hope to get? A good next step then within there is to think about the personas, which most companies already are pretty good at. Like, you know, what are the types of people you're going to be speaking to? How can we refine those in order to get closer to the individual? So if we're already talking about a job function level, okay, great, but what about by job function by sector? And what about job function by sector and by location? And all these sorts of things, where are you going to break up the data in order to get down to the individual or as close to the individual as possible? And then, of course, you need the data to actually serve those segments. So you're kind of creating a funnel like this to allow you to get to the point. And from the companies that we work with, everything that I've just said tends to be something either that they feel that they already are doing to some degree or that they can do. It's within their power to do it. The data thing can be a sticking point. But the point where most companies that we work with are stuck, and I was reading some research just ahead of this call which supported this, was around the technology. It's the execution of the thing where most companies struggle. So you've got to line your thing up so that you know what you're trying to do, why you're trying to do it. You've got the different building blocks to allow you to address the individual in some meaningful way. And then the kind of the elephant in the room is, how actually are we going to make this happen? Because, you know, email is really easy just to drop in a merge tag or whatever, but content generally or your website, all of these sorts of things, that's a totally different prospect.
So you talked about technology there as being one of the issues, but actually before that, you were talking about data. So I'm keen to unpick the data issues, perhaps, first of all. What are the typical issues that businesses scaling up face on the data front, and how can they overcome them?
So those are difficult questions. Well, the first one's easier. The data is typically about the quality and the availability. So what I mean by that is you may know exactly what you want to say to someone with these particular characteristics or a role with these particular characteristics. But do you know those characteristics about your contact book? Does your CRM contain those data fields? And can you rely on them? You know, because it's a very bad thing to send someone something that's personalized for a different persona or whatever. So it's really that data and the quality of the data. And, you know, in a big business, that can be a real challenge. I mean, we are relatively small in the grand scheme of things, but staying on top of our CRM and making sure that the data in there can be relied upon, because we do a lot of this personalization, as you can imagine, that's a challenge. So data integrity and reliability is what I'm referring to there.
And then you also talked there about being focused upon what you were aiming to get out of personalization. So I wonder if we can make that practical in terms of examples. Perhaps you can give me one or two instances of and perhaps describe either name the company, or if you can't name the company, perhaps the type of sector or the type of industry that they're in. And tell us perhaps what they were able to get out of a personalization exercise.
Right. So I'm thinking of a couple of companies, particularly in the tech sector. One that we worked with where they're doing reports. You know, so they've got a particular perspective on the industry, and they found that sure, people read these reports, but they had the hypothesis that they would be able to increase the readership and the engagement and the value of these reports if they were tailored. So if we're going to be talking about 100 different topics in this report, they know that I work for a particular type of company, they know my role, I only would see certain elements of that report. And so they did that. They were able to take that report, they were able to carve it up into pieces, and then put it back together dynamically on the fly in response to the person who was reading it. And what they saw was a significant increase in the amount of time people spend engaging with the content, far better conversion rate following on. And going back to the psychology that I was talking about before, you know, it's always good to see those things played out, because what the psychology behind it tells us is that when we see something that we believe and has been personalized for us, it's specific to us, we believe, rightly or wrongly, hopefully rightly, that someone somewhere has taken the time to work out that this is not going to be a waste of our time. And so we make the time to go through it because we believe, hopefully rightly, that this is going to be a valuable use of our time rather than we're going to have to wade through a load of stuff. So that's kind of one example where they wanted to increase readership. I was talking about deeper relationships before. That's a great example of that as well. They were able to do that very successfully. Another example is another tech business. We do quite a lot with tech businesses where they wanted to turn their salespeople, rather than talking about product features and speeds and feeds, they wanted them to tell stories around the functionality and what that functionality can do. But what they realized is the problem with the story is that you need to be able to personalize the story to be relevant to the individual you're speaking to. And so we worked with them to pull that together, basically, and to have a system where a salesperson can say, I need this kind of story for this kind of person in this kind of area, and off you go and you get that personalized story. And that was tremendously effective as well. They were looking to increase, obviously, engagement with the content and revenue off the back of it. So those are two kind of examples to give a flavor.
And we've been talking there about outputs. What about the inputs? How much effort and money do you have to put in to be able to get the sort of return that you're talking about?
Well, it's one of those interesting things where actually you can bizarrely end up saving money. And we've seen this with a few of our customers where so much effort goes into creating so much content. There's so much duplication of effort. And there's so much, particularly in a sales context, there's so many people trying to solve similar problems that if you take a step back and take a more strategic sort of content operations approach and you consider it like that, you can actually end up creating efficiencies. So, for example, you imagine that you're an ABM team and you're trying to engage with your 50 target prospects. There's a huge amount of, potentially agency time or internal design time that has to go into servicing those content assets. Well, if you take a step back and you try and work out what are the underlying patterns within the engagement that we're seeing, you can create a set of content that then can be personalized on the fly. You do it once, but you use it hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of times. And so there is an initial kind of outlay in terms of getting started, both in terms of kind of cognitive effort, but also resources to get that done. But once you're done with that, you're actually in a position where you can use that for free, pretty much extensively. And so you can start to actually see savings.
So real value for money then?
Absolutely. That's what we're all about, Dave.
CEO of Turtle, Nick Mason, thank you very much.
Thank you.
My final guest talking personalization is the director of Rich Contacts, Simon Watson. Simon, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Dave. How are you doing?
Very good, thank you. Very good. Tell us a bit about Rich Contacts.
Absolutely. Well, we're a B2B sales agency, predominantly focusing on outbound marketing, but we provide a whole range of B2B sales services, really everything from contact through to contract. So if you need a boost of leads and some outbound activity, we can take care of that. Or if you need some data to be built in order for you to do the contacting, we can support with that too. All the way through to providing more along the lines of sort of consultancy-based services or project-based services that may support businesses with things like developing a proposal or developing rate cards or actually all the way through to negotiating and agreeing upon contracts and so forth. So it's a sort of there's a wide range of services within that, but I'd say a lot of what we do is in the outbound marketing realm, and we use multiple channels for that.
Okay, and we're talking about personalization today. So within all of that, and perhaps with some of your past experience as well, what are your qualifications to be talking to us about personalization today, Simon?
I think everything that we do as an organization is focused on a humanized approach, and we have a strap line which is providing humanized outreach at scale. And I think the term humanized, you could replace that with sort of maybe personalized, it's a slight nuance, but the approach is to build conversations with other human beings And in order to do that, it's quite helpful to know their first name to start with. So a lot of what we do is to unearth the people on the organizations we want to talk to. We unearth a certain level of personal data, and I use that word fairly cautiously, but very basic things like first name is very, very helpful. So we do this humanized outreach at scale approach for a number of different B2B organizations, and we always, without exception, provide a level of personalization in whichever channel we choose or are being asked to operate on behalf of our customers.
So does that mean that you define personalization as humanized outreach at scale?
I think for us, it's a fine line between the two. So, you know, we focus in on the top to middle of the funnel, the lead funnel. And in order to do that with a level of personalization, there are some limitations. So understanding someone's date of birth and shoe size, or whether they prefer dogs over cats at the top of a lead funnel is unnecessary.
Sure.
If you're down further towards the point at which a customer may agree to a contract, it could be very beneficial to know that they prefer cats over dogs. So I think the level of personalization is dictated by the point at which they're in the sales or marketing funnel within a particular organization.
Okay, and does that mean then, if we're looking at how you apply technology to personalization, that means I guess you must adjust that application through the funnel?
I would say yes, but again, it depends on where they are in the funnel. So which channel we've chosen to use. So we use three predominant channels, I would say. That's it's email, LinkedIn, and the phone.
Okay.
And the phone element is a really interesting topic. It was in fashion, it was the only option, and then it went out of fashion. And it's very much a key component to a successful marketing and sales strategy in today's world, even more so given that we're, you know, the date is end of April to 2020. Yeah. Right now, and people are all locked up in their homes.
Yeah.
So I think the level of personalization is dictated by the channel. I think with a cold email or an email that goes out, you know, there's less personalization that's needed. It's more about the relevancy of the message. But when you get to a point where you're nurturing a lead, you've had an engagement maybe on email, LinkedIn, and the phone, and then the subsequent engagements become more phone-based, then there's a much greater need to provide personalization within that. And again, that humanized touch, you know, to bring those people in over the line ultimately.
So how can technology help?
Technology enables scale, really. And I think there's some very easy wins with certain, again, particularly from an email and LinkedIn perspective, there's some easy wins to provide personalization at scale. You know, I mentioned just dropping the name, the first name into an email. It's so basic, and all email sequencing tools will provide that. If they don't provide it, you should probably switch tools. But it's a, you know, for those that are less familiar with it, it's a piece of code, effectively. It's a variable that will extract or pull a name from a database. If we're emailing Dave Stevens, there will be a variable in that tool that says, you know, dear first name as opposed to dear Dave. And it's that small snippet really of code which can pull from a database and then layer that into an email, you know, email outreach. And so again, it's a relatively basic thing, but it's you know, if you don't know, you don't know. But that first name can be replaced with all sorts of other variables or variants to bring a level of personalization at a relatively easy and low cost way.
Okay. So help me with the kind of reverse of that question then. How not to apply technology?
How not to apply technology? Well,
can you go too far with your application of technology to personalization?
I think if you're going to deploy, like if you're going to use technology to interrogate or lift information from a personal social network, which are to a degree open publicly, I think there's a danger there of just coming across a bit creepy. You know,
stalking your target audience.
Well, that's it, right? So if you're, you know, again, if we were looking to target your good self, Dave, and I didn't really know you that well personally, and I happened to find you on LinkedIn and then navigated to Instagram and navigated to Twitter and then found you on Quora and then found that, you know, you had a particular interest in you know, beach holidays in the Maldives and a certain type of cocktail, and you know that your favorite color was green. Great, right? I mean, great that I've learned that, but does that really
does it help
right? And it probably doesn't. As I say, it goes back to my original point. I think when you're in a point where this is handed over and it's now in an active sales engagement, and that person now building actual rapport and building a real relationship with someone, it could be quite helpful to know that they like green, because the Christmas card we're going to send them might have a green stripe across the middle. I don't know. I'm making it up.
Sure.
But yeah, there's definitely a point at which personalization becomes creepy. I think there's a fine line, another fine line between personalization and relevance. So as a CMO, a piece of content that's relevant to you and could even be addressed to you and written almost specifically for you is possibly irrelevant for a marketing exec who's just taken their first step on the ladder, or a marketing person that's several steps up the ladder. They may not really care about P&L type question or P&L related topics, whereas, you know, you may live and breathe that subject on a weekly basis. So I think relevancy is closely tied to personalization. I think there's a bit of a fine line between the two sometimes.
Okay. Can you give us an example of a business that does personalization well?
You mean other than us?
Well, by all means, tell us how brilliant Rich Contacts is again. That helps.
No. I'm teasing. Who does personalization really well? I tell you who does, and this is going to sound like a bit of a plug. I tell you who does personalization really well. And there's a company that we work with. They're a publisher, actually. They're a B2B publisher, essentially, with 140-ish website, you know, across their network. But it's a company called Tech Target, and it's a publisher, as I say, and you, as a consumer, you sign up to digest data and information and content, videos, white papers, you know, that sort of thing. What's really smart about their infrastructure is they learn what that user is reading and what they're most interested in. And then their algorithms are building bespoke, on-the-fly, subsequent emails to then feed you with more information that's relevant. So if I was interested in IoT and I've submitted my details onto the Tech Targets platform and I've digested content related to IoT and, you know, let's say project management software, I don't know, maybe I'm interested in these two things today, the algorithm will understand what I've digested. It will then create a cadence of email, typically, but the content of that email is curated on the fly based upon my search criteria and my interests. And then you're into a funnel. You're then in a cadence of emails that are highly relevant and, again, arguably personalized because they're addressed to me, they're addressed to my pain points or the things that I'm interested in. And it keeps me coming back to their site. So I think they do that remarkably well. And I don't even think the algorithms are, you know, it's not like they're using AI, right? I mean, they possibly may use an element of AI, but I just think it's just smart logic. And they've placed that logic into an email sequence, which is impactful.
So there's a completely impartial recommendation. Simon Watson, Director at Rich Contacts, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave. Take care now.
To something different now, Gail Cogswell shares a key lesson that she's taken on the journey to becoming a business consultant in the 5G space. Gail, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
What's made you the brilliant B2B marketer that you are today then?
Well, thank you, first of all. Quite happy to take brilliant. there are two aspects, I think, that are very important. The first is breadth of experience. Okay. I am a B2B marketer, like you say, but I've come to that point via a route of doing some B2C. Which I know is a swear word to some B2B marketers, isn't it?
We'll let it through for now.
Ultimately, although, you know, I mean, they're very different disciplines, as you're aware, but when you get to certain, like, for example, if you're doing base marketing, if you're looking at retention, customer sat, opportunity of growth, etc., often your B is a collection of consumers at that point. So there is some overlap in the disciplines of both. And I feel sort of quite lucky to have had that range of understanding of them. But I've also had a breadth of scale of business. So I've worked with sole traders through to multinationals. I've worked in public sector and private sector, which are completely different disciplines. And I've been very lucky in that I've worked over quite a lot of the world as well. So you get that cultural difference in there. So that breadth sort of gives you such exposure to so many things. And I'm a bit of a sponge when it comes to learning. So all of that experience goes into the mix then and sort of becomes part of your skill set. I've always, in my career, I've always liked to do new challenges, new industries, new subject matters. And in order to do that, you need to be able to work out what is your transferable marketing skill set. So what are the tools of your trade versus what is the knowledge of a particular subject matter? Now, there's no right or wrong in this. You get some fantastic marketers who are subject matter experts. I am not one of those. I am someone who likes to take what I am good at, which is understanding the insight and growing the marketing from that. But I like to apply that to any base possible. So having that breadth of experience and knowledge is incredibly useful. I think then on a more innate basis, I am a sponge when it comes to learning. I absolutely love learning new stuff. So having a curiosity that constantly wants to understand why, what makes something that way, what are the key drivers, tell me more about that, is really just insight finding. My partner has told me many a time that when you go on a wine tasting tour, at the end of it, they say, has anyone got any questions? And the whole group are thinking, don't ask the question. This is a bit where we get to taste the wine. I've got about 20 questions. And that's whether I'm in a vineyard or whether I'm walking around sort of a aerospace manufacturing centre. I just love to find out those questions.
Just so, wait until they've poured the wine first.
I know, that's the trick, isn't it? Wait till everyone else has a full glass and then start boring them. But yeah, so I think that's sort of just a natural part of who I am. But I think those two things combined just give me a very transferable skill set.
How does breadth of experience help, though, within the B2B marketing area? Can you perhaps give me an example of where you've gone and been able to apply the broader experience that you have, maybe in different organizations, as you say, or maybe in different types of marketing, you've been able to apply that within a role that you've got?
Yeah, and sometimes it can be as much as when I've been working with smaller businesses, often they will have seen a larger business's marketing campaign that they've been very impressed with and therefore sort of want to replicate, but it's not relevant to their business, either their scale or their customer base. And on a really sort of brass tacks level, talking once with a small manufacturing, and we're talking trading estate size, and they were saying, you know, we really love things like Goldfish credit card, and I think Orange had just done the Futures Bright, and you know, that was sort of the flavor of branding at the time, and they were saying we want one of those, and I was sort of able to say to them that doesn't really work for your market, because it does what it says on the tin type business, and tried to talk them down from sort of getting excited about the giddy side of, you know, the creative side of marketing, because it wouldn't have, they could have spent an awful lot of money on it. There'd have been a lot of agencies queuing up to do the work, but it wasn't really the question that they needed to answer. You know, there were much more pressing things that they had to address about their core product set without getting distracted by that. And I think it's having that experience and saying, well, actually, I worked with O2 when they became O2, you know, when we had to trademark bubbles and things like that. And it's suitable for that type of industry. It's not suitable for 10 people with a couple of laser cutting machines. So there's that type of practical application. There's also sometimes the art of being able to gently take people away from what they think they want to understanding what they really want. And you only do that through repeat practice, I believe. So I worked with a global car manufacturer, this was in China, who were convinced that they wanted big data. They didn't know what they wanted big data for particularly, but they wanted big data because it's you know, the new shiny thing that everyone wanted. And I could have provided that big data. I worked for a big data startup at the time. I could have given them gigabytes of data, but to do what in? To sit and drown in, you know? They hadn't really identified what the question was that they wanted the data to answer. Right. So being able to sort of say to them, yes, you can have all that data, absolutely. Before I provide you with that data, can we just go back and do some? And we ended up just doing some sort of quite basic questioning techniques to really understand what it was they were trying to understand about their base. The answer was in big data, but it wasn't in the data lake they were asking for. It was for a much more sort of nuanced set of skills. I think by saying to those people, when I worked with TFL, when I worked with and being able to tell them big chunky organizations with similar sized data requirements, immediately builds up that confidence in people that you do know what you're talking about. And even though you're politely telling them they're wrong at this stage, they're quite happy to go with you down that journey.
So does it matter what experience you get breadth of? You know, so I guess, is your advice to people, well, just to do lots of different things, or is it possible to be a bit more strategic about which things you do more of?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, to start with, I would say you have to know which way you want your career to go. There is a rather dismissive term, I think, that used to be used a bit of calling people tall poppies. The idea that you would grow upwards and be sort of straight and strong in one discipline as though that were a bad thing. And that's not necessarily a bad thing at all. That's just not the route I've chosen to take. So I think for some people, what I do would fill them with horror, and they'd think how awful having to start again every 3 to 6 months. And I absolutely get that. And sometimes I also feel that, so they're not entirely wrong. It can be exhausting. You have to pick and choose what the experience is. Sometimes there are opportunities that come up that just don't fit my MO. FMCG, I have no interest in. That type of marketing isn't for me. There are certain types of startup activities that already now I know I've done once. That's all part of the experience as well, isn't it? You learn what you love, you learn what you don't love, and there's absolutely no, there's no fault in doing something that you don't love once. But if you repeat that activity, you're not learning, you're not adding to the skill set, you know, you're, it's just of no value to anyone. So yeah, absolutely, you have to pick and choose. You have to learn from your mistakes, and you've got to know what excites you. And like I say, everything I do has got this common thread of innovation and an element of newness about it, whether the tech itself is new or whether it's a new business venture that's trying to sort of go and disrupt an existing sector. There's always got to be something new in there, and a little bit of let's make it up as we go along.
And then coming to the curiosity point, does it get more difficult to maintain your curiosity as you go further through your career?
Not yet. It hasn't. No. And the last project that I was working on, which was based in 5G, but I was working across industries. So I was looking at construction, manufacturing, and healthcare, which on the face of it don't have an awful lot in common. And I found it equally exciting to work out how major construction works, for example, the HS2 program that's going on in the Midlands at the moment, through to what really goes on in the back of an ambulance when a paramedic's doing their job. So I think that's really exciting. People used to joke saying I had the boring sectors because I had to put like hard hat and wellies on to go to my customers. And I think little do you know, because you can take people around a modern factory today. It's incredible. The amount of innovation going on in there is a real eye opener.
So that kind of infers that curiosity is an innate skill. It's not something that you can learn. It's something that you just have.
I think you can develop it. I think I agree with you. I think it probably is innate. And if you are not somebody that finds these things interesting, then it's going to be a slog. You know, you can't go in there. If you're trying to convince customers, and an awful lot of what I do, business development and marketing, I think have sort of got closer and closer together of late. And when it comes to innovation, business development has one foot in sales, you know, this all becomes a bit more of a hybrid skill set. Authenticity is a major part of that. And if you're saying to people, I've got something new, it's never been done before, do you want to be part of the team that tests this for the first time? I can't guarantee it will be brilliant. You know, you might lose time and money on it. You've got to be authentic. Now, if you're not genuinely interested in what you're trying to achieve, I don't think people are going to go on that journey with you. So yes, I think it does have to be innate. You can hone your skills. I mean, this is what journalists learn, isn't it? It's how to ask questions, when to pick up on a glint in someone's eye, which means there's probably more to that than they've let on with the initial answer. You can sort of finesse those skills, but yes, I think you've got to have that natural drive in you.
Gail Cogswell, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that's it. That's all for this episode of the Business Marketing Club podcast. Thanks to my guests, Sameet Vamani, Nick Mason, Simon Watson, and Gail Cogswell. Please do let us know what you think of today's podcast. Give us a rating or a review, or drop us a line at businessmarketingclub.org.uk. And if you've got something interesting, practical, and visionary to share with our listeners, why not volunteer to be a guest on a future podcast? But no pitches, presentations, or promos, please. We're interested in your thinking and your practical examples. If you've enjoyed the podcast, why not look out in your area for Business Marketing Club mentoring, thought leadership, and events for the B2B marketing community? In fact, what's stopping you from doing that right now? I hope to see you again. I'm Dave Stevens. Thanks for listening.